Welcome to the Conestoga Podcast. This is Program 20 for December 12, 2006. Conestoga is Oklahoma's largest literary science fiction and fantasy convention. I'm Chris Marley, your podcast host, and it's time for another podcast recorded at Conestoga 10. This time, it's author James P. Hogan. He was spending a few weeks in the U.S., and we were honored to have him as our first convention stop. And now, James P. Hogan. I want to welcome James P. Hogan. He is our special guest at Conestoga this year. I'm Chris Merle, podcast host. Thank you for coming all the way from Ireland to be here.
Glad to be back, Chris. Yeah, back is back in the 80s, and I lived in Northwest Florida, so this became one of my local cons every year. It was OCon in those days, famous for its parties and its various forms of bright life. And I suppose, Arnold Schwarzenegger, General MacArthur, Jesus Christ, I threatened I'd be back, and here I am.
Well, we're glad to have you. Of course, I know we're not the only convention you're going to. I think you're going to be at Armadillo Con as well.
Well, that's right. It started with Armadillo Con in the middle of August. I'm the guest of honor there in Austin, Texas. And I have some friends here from old times and more recent times in Tulsa. So I thought, well, let's arrive ahead of time. There's a science conference in Portland, Oregon next weekend. Not science fiction, but a lot of scientists whose work I like, and some of them are personal friends. It would be nice to say hello to again. I have a daughter who lives just north of Los Angeles, and I thought, well, why not wind up with Worldcon in LA at the end of the month? So we'll have an August tripping around the west of the USA.
Well, you've got a pretty busy schedule. I'm not sure when this podcast will be posted, so they may hear about these plans afterwards.
But that's okay.
We plan on releasing them over the next 6 months. Now, one thing, I guess, being an author, we also want to know about your latest works. Now, your most recent book is Mission to Minerva, and it's out in hardcover. It's supposed to be mass market in September, which is not too far away. And it's the fifth novel in the Inherit the Stars series.
The Giant series.
And if listeners aren't familiar with the Giant series, did you plan on having this many books in the series?
No, I didn't plan on it being a series at all. Inherit the Stars was the first book I wrote. It was published in 1977 and has not been out of print since then.
Wow.
Which is quite a record. And it was my debut into becoming a writer, which, as with many things of my life, sort of happened without any planning at all. I started out as an electronics engineer, a digital systems designer. Mm-hmm. I originally did custom built, back in the 60s now, early 60s, custom designed digital controlled and instrumentation systems in scientific and industrial applications. And the natural path of evolution was into computers. Mm-hmm. When those applications became programmable software, we're talking about boxes 20 feet long full of hardwired logic that could only be changed with a soldering iron. When this was turned into a 19-inch programmable computer in the form of, before Digital Equipment's PDP series, Honeywell actually had their 16-bit series. Mm-hmm. And I was involved in that. Into sales, and then writing sort of emerged in the mid-70s. As a bet to start with, an office bet. And full-time since about 1980.
Oh, well, some people get started on a dare.
It was an office bet.
Wow. And I gather you won the office bet?
Well, life was fine. I was selling computers around Europe, and pretty good money, pretty varied life, a lot of interesting subjects to think about and get involved in. I saw a movie you've probably heard of called 2001.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm tongue-in-cheek. On panels, I say, how many people saw the movie 2001? Every hand in the room goes up, of course. And I then ask, how many people understood the ending to 2001? And maybe one or two hands half-heartedly flutter. Mm-hmm. And I love the movie. I love the technical authenticity. I think the orbiting space station was a TWA. The shuttle was TWA. The space station was a Hilton.
I believe it was Pan Am and a Hilton.
And the logo on the pilot's console was IBM.
Ah, okay.
And this was real. It could be the world my children grow up in. And all the way through the movie, I, on the edge of my seat, waiting for it to be resolved in, you know, a satisfying way. And it ended up with all this mysterious mystic symbolism with babies in bubbles and old men dropping wine glasses. And I didn't understand it. And the next day in the office, I'm still complaining about this. And just to shut me up, somebody said, well, if you can write something that makes more sense, go do it. I said I would. I shamelessly stole Arthur's plot line. The idea of a scientific mystery turning up in the process of 21st century lunar exploration that got the whole scientific community excited was attractive. And we made it a mystery thriller, a dead body found in a spacesuit on the moon. A bit odd at first, since none of the bases have reported anybody missing. Gets interesting when they find he's been there for 50,000 years.
Yeah, that would be a bit of a mystery.
Yeah, and the book then was the story of, you know, from the evidence they had, the corpse, the backpack, the spacesuit, putting together a picture of the world he came from. But getting back to your question, it was I was about halfway through that book when I realized, well, there's another story to be told here. So I had a sequel in mind before I finished Inherit the Stars, and interestingly, Judy Lynn Del Rey, who was the editor-in-chief at Ballantine at that time, had also come to the same conclusion, and somehow two turned into three. And then it got a bit like Sherlock Holmes, that Conan Doyle was constantly trying to end the series and turn to other things, and the readers wouldn't let him. In fact, he killed Holmes off at one point and had to bring him back again. And the readers made me write a fourth and then a fifth, and that's what we're up to now.
So what can they expect for Mission to Minerva in the latest installment?
Well, each one, it's more than an installment. Each of the books is a self-contained story in itself.
Okay.
I wouldn't inflict on readers, you know, you're all wound up waiting for it to finish, and on the, you flip over the last page and it says, to be continued. No, I tear it up in disgust and not buy another one. So we do tell a complete story. You don't have to read them in the right order, but it helps. Each one builds on the other. Mission to Minerva, well, I can't go too deeply into it because it wouldn't mean a lot for readers who haven't read the original ones in the series. But the end of Giant Star, the third in the book, the fleeing aliens had been had gone into a peculiar a convolution of space-time that resulted from two supercomputers battling each other over light years of distance, and somehow got hurled back in time to reappear at the planet Minerva, which in the series occupied a position in the solar system between Mars and Jupiter, eventually became the asteroids. But 50,000 years ago was destroyed, and our mysterious corpse that was found on the moon, his origins were tracked back to this now non-existent planet. So the physics of time travel was implied.
Okay.
At the end of Giant Star, and since it was right at the end of the book, we knew no more. And given the personalities of Vic Hunt, Dan Checker, the various characters we developed in that series, and the aliens who showed up, we get aliens, we got everything in this series. When other more pressing needs are taken care of, which was the fourth in the series, Enterverse, they're going to try and get together and figure out what happened at the end of Giant Star. So Mission to Minerva begins with a joint investigation by the Earth scientists and the aliens. These are friendly aliens. We get on very well with them. To try to unravel what happened in those last moments. And we get into the physics of the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, the multiverse. But from we get into it not simply through the author invents a magic conjurer's box, you get into it and you can travel across the multiverse. A bit like Genesis Machine, the actual physics unravels itself. We get into the we get an idea of the physics, and a better understanding of the physics leads to the possibility that, hey, maybe we can harness this knowledge and actually, although the original thoughts were it's impossible for these universes to communicate, we start to suspect that maybe it's not so. maybe we can change what happened in those last moments of Giant Star.
This brings up an interesting question. Now, you've been writing this series for, well, almost 2 decades now, or a little over 2 decades.
Yes.
And since it's hard science fiction, the science that we know in creating it has changed what we know about it. Has that helped or hindered you in writing these stories?
We've managed to absorb it fairly smoothly, I'd say. That none of the science that was described or anticipated in Inherit the Stars has needed to be revised because it clashed with things we discovered subsequently. Mm-hmm. And the new ideas that are presented in Mission for Minerva, I would say, are pretty much right in line with current thinking about quantum models, multiverse mathematics, and that kind of thing. And the reader comments that we get, for example, on the Amazon reviews, mm-hmm. have all remarked on the same point that you just made, and expressed the view that, hey, it looks as if it looks fresh, that the series began 25 years ago, and yet here's the latest, and it could have continued on immediately after the most recent book. So I think we've done a pretty good job of keeping it up to date.
I think that's a much bigger challenge because a fantasy writer, they can, you know, their world is pretty static, and it doesn't involve knowing anything about science or physics or anything like that other than what's available to that particular universe.
Yeah, strange, isn't it? Yeah. We could go off on that tangent if you like.
Well, that's not necessary. I think I prefer hard science fiction myself. Right. So not only do you you write a lot of fiction, but you also you write a number of essays. As a matter of fact, another recent issue was Catastrophes, Chaos, and Convolutions.
Right.
It just came out in December of 2005, and I was looking at the table of contents, and one of the titles intrigued me. You didn't have the essay online. You've got a fair number of others. Was why do readers always ask? Mm-hmm. And I think it's the where do you get your ideas type question. These the questions that kind of annoy authors, or that they're a little, it's like, why do they always ask that? You know, because they're the same question over and over again.
That's true. The I've actually proposed this topic for panel subjects at some conventions where writers are invited, you know, to share with the audience their thoughts on what questions do you hate being asked by readers the most.
Mm-hmm.
And when, in between panels and other things, writers get together in a bar, it's a topic that sometimes comes up. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, when you compare the lists of most hated questions that different writers come up with, they show amazing similarities. And one of the questions that appears on everybody's list, it seems, is, where do you get your ideas from? And I'm not sure why it is that we all don't like being asked this question, but the piece that you refer to in that collection was an attempt to address this with the forlorn hope that maybe if I get an answer out here in mass print, perhaps it'll reduce the number of times it gets asked in real life at panels. But I think that there's something... There is no simple answer to this. There is only one place you get your ideas from. You read, you ask questions, you listen, you observe the world,
mm-hmm.
you think about what you hear and see, and you put it all together and you write. It's the form of the question, to my ears, it seems to imply a trick that makes it easy, that the professionals know. And there's a tongue-in-cheek answer. They'll often say, oh, yeah, well, there's a subscription service in Chicago that costs, you know, $50 a month, and they send you 2 ideas a month. Uh-huh. And there is no shortcut. It's hard work. It's sustained work. It's a lot of effort. And you're putting a lot on the line. When 12 months is probably a fair period of time for anybody to spend trying to put their first novel together. It's a huge learning experience with a very steep learning curve. And you have, for a year of your life, you've given something your absolute best you've got.
Mm-hmm.
You've sweated blood over this. And it takes a lot at the end of that to be told not good enough, for example, or to get the kind of criticisms you get from people who have never tried it. This is one of the reasons why writers make very bad judges. Sometimes we get... A would-be writer, an aspiring writer, they've written a manuscript. Would you like to look at my work?
Uh-huh.
And I'm very reluctant to, because writers know what goes into it. They're too soft. You need a hard-nosed New York editor.
Well, there's a corollary I've seen. A lot of editors and writers will have panels at convention. They call them liar's panels. And they make up things like, oh, yeah, you know, you can call the editor any time, day and night. Or and there's all sorts of things. And it's they can be very, very amusing. Uh-huh. And I think it's a way of venting steam when you get the "where do you get your ideas" question. Maybe. And I think there might be an answer. Actually, I was listening to an audio tape. It was actually Richard P. Feynman, can you explain in 2 minutes why you got the Nobel Prize? And this cabbie gave him this wonderful answer. He says, "Well, if I could explain it in 2 minutes, I wouldn't have won the Nobel Prize." Sort of kind of pushes off the question. So you might be able to use that. Where do you get your ideas? Well, if I could explain it, you know, answer you in one question, I wouldn't be writing a novel or something like that.
That's a good answer. And, you know, I'm sort of having trouble now coherently answering it in a short amount of time. It takes a length of the novel to answer it, really. And the ideas, they come from where the origin, the places I listed to begin with. You listen, you hear, you read a lot, you go places. Never turn down an opportunity to travel. Never turn down an opportunity to meet people. Learn to get along with everybody, from drunks in sleazy bars to CEOs of Fortune 500 companies and people with English nobility titles. Mm-hmm. They all see the world from a different perspective. They all have something fresh to bring, a fresh point of view that they can share. And this is the first job that the writer has to do, I think, to create the worlds that writers create in their fiction. I believe that the human mind never really creates anything genuinely new out of nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, try to imagine a new color. What we do, I think, is we put familiar things together in new combinations, new configurations, or we see a familiar idea or concept from a different angle. So the material has to come from the outside. The raw material from which innovation comes, it doesn't arise internally.
Well, that's one of the appeals of science fiction, is that is looking at the world in a different way, and there are as many different ways of looking at the world as there are writers.
Well, there are as many different ways of looking at the world as there are 6 billion people out there in it, and the more of those 6 billion. You listen to and share and learn and pick up a little bit from, the richer the mix you have to draw from will be.
Okay. I also want to ask you a little bit about Ireland, because that's where you're currently residing.
It is.
And I got to my first trip to Ireland. We got to see a lot of it, although I believe you're up in Galway. Is that correct?
Well, I'm in the northwest.
Northwest.
Near a town called Sligo, which is about halfway between Galway and Donegal.
Yeah, the closest we got was Galway. We went up to Inishmore and all that. It was an amazing country. I could tell as a country in transition, the economy is booming. Lots of foreign nationals coming to work there. I saw construction everywhere in Dublin. Even in the rural areas, there was a lot of construction. Is there a lot of that going up in your area as well?
There's a lot of changes going on in Sligo town itself. In the farther outlying areas, a lot of private residences are starting to appear. I think in the last 5 years, the population is up to 4.5 million from about 3.5. That's a huge increase. I'm told a lot of Irish are returning from places like the United States now. Mm-hmm.
We went on a boat tour, and they had quoted a statistic of something like 20,000 expatriates are coming back now a year.
That's really?
Yeah. Of course, there's still lots of Irish coming in as well. So, do you have any comments about the changes that you're seeing in Ireland? How long have you lived there now?
Well, I'm an Irish citizen,
right?
But I've lived there full time for about the last 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. Before that, I'd been living there since about 1987, but I also had a residence in Florida. I was going backwards and forwards between the two.
So you've seen a lot of changes in Ireland over the past few decades.
Yeah, yeah. As you say, it's becoming more cosmopolitan, more. A lot of the modern world is finding its way in. Postcard Ireland, in my opinion, sad to say, is disappearing. Mm-hmm. But it seems to be the way of the world. What more can one say? It seems to have its own character and its own charm, which I don't think will die.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's being very selective. It's selectively adding to itself. It's overlaying traditional Ireland with a lot of the modern world that it decides it takes to. But I don't think it's going to lose its core flavor and character underneath.
Well, I kind of hope, like Japan, even though Japan's a very modern country, they've retained a lot of their traditional culture, and I'm hoping that Ireland will do the same.
Good analogy. I think there's a lot of the narrow thinking, a lot of the strict religious thinking that used to be part of Ireland. The traditional people have reservations. Personally, I think that the broadening of outlook that we see in the younger people will lead to, I think, a more rational, very, very vigorous culture. I'm happy to be there. I can't think of many other places in the world I'd rather be.
Well, it's a beautiful country, and I certainly want to go back someday.
A little bit pricey, but like Rolls Royces, you get what you pay for.
Yeah, Pint of Guinness is a little pricey, but it was worth it.
Ah.
Now, I think what we'll do is we'll travel back, since we're going to go back to this country now,
right.
And you have a great interest in science. You're going to a science conference in Portland here in the next couple of weeks. But what are some of the things that attract you to these conferences? You know, you have friends there, but what are some of the things that you're interested in? Any particular technology?
All of it across the board, really. In more recent years, we could get into some heavy stuff here. I've always been interested in science since I was a teenager. I'd say it was Isaac Asimov's nonfiction that was one of the factors. Science was always interesting, but Asimov's nonfiction added an extra ingredient to the mix that showed, hey, it can be fun too.
Yeah.
He had a quality of humor that you don't get from many professional scientists. Feynman maybe, but they're exceptions.
Now, I've had a chance to read a few of your essays, and I notice you're not afraid to tackle some controversial subjects. I don't want to necessarily mention any particular,
I think one of the things that's been happening, I think a lot of areas of science have becoming very rigid in their outlook, very institutionalized, taking on the trappings of more of an intolerant religion, defending dogma and putting down heresy, rather than exhibiting the open-mindedness to new evidence, new information, new ideas that challenge the reigning orthodoxy in the way that the textbooks tell us and the apologists for science tell us the way science works. But disturbingly, many, many times one finds that in the real world it's not quite that simple.
Yeah, you know, Feynman covers that extensively.
Yeah.
He talks about what's called cargo cult science, in that
they
do the trappings of science, but they're not actually practicing science. They're not actually trying to discover something new, or that I was, you know, hey, the experiment didn't work. That worked. We'll have to go do something else.
Yeah, we could go into specific if you like, but then we'd risk getting partisan.
But that's okay.
But years ago, I sometimes made the observation that compared to other areas of human thought and belief systems, such as religions, political ideologies, economic doctrines, science was the only area of human belief where it actually really matters whether or not what you believe is true. And now I'm not so sure. I look at some of the far-flung, huge theories of cosmology, of the origins of life, some of these very, very big questions. And the degree to which it rests on a philosophy and an ideology first, and the actual factual evidence, when I get the feeling, is more selected to conform to the ideology. So the belief system came first, and the rationalization of the support for the belief system was added selectively afterward. But this is more the way religious belief structures have traditionally come into existence. So now I kind of restrict that aphorism to engineering. Engineering is the only human field of human endeavor in which it matters whether or not you believe is true, because if you've got your figures wrong, your plane won't fly. You can fool yourself if you like. You can fool as many people as you can get away with it for as long as you can get away with it, but you can't fool reality. Your motor won't turn, your plane won't fly, your machine won't work.
Or the bridge won't hold up.
And so maybe it's no coincidence. I think if we look at the books I've written in more recent years, the protagonists have tended to be engineers rather than scientists.
Well, yeah, an engineer has to know whether it's going to work or not, and they can go back to the drawing board to figure out what went wrong.
Uh-huh. Well, I think a lot of the science that we see, a lot of the science that the scientific media and press likes to present to the public, to more often than not over-sensationalized, in my opinion, I think a lot of the scientists bask in the false limelight that actually is earned by engineering. They're not the same thing. They point to things like computers, transistors, silicon circuits, airplane engines, telephones, and it all works. But these are successful applications of technology. And very, very often, if we look over the last few centuries, the pioneering wasn't done by the theorists in academia working out models and mathematics. It was done by guys with soldering irons and rolled up sleeves. People with a practical bent, perhaps, who just wanted to develop a steam engine that worked, or just what they had this passion to want to know, and they muddled their way through and made something that worked, and the academic work to try and form the theory that explained what they did, and very often came later. Mm-hmm. Watt didn't invent the steam engine, he improved Newcomen's engine for pumping out coal mines, but they had that working long before the theories of thermodynamics, and people put together models of heat engines and entropy and enthalpy and all the rest of it. So when the proponents of theories of Big Bang cosmology, and they're telling us that they can tell us within so many nanoseconds, or sometimes high powers of 10, fractions of nanoseconds of the Big Bang, they can describe what happened to a position where the 51st digit of a number makes all the difference between the incipient universe collapsing to nothing or instantly expanding to infinity. I'm kind of suspicious here that the mathematical model is floated away up into the realms of fantasy, in my opinion. Well, and the fact that an aeroplane engine works has absolutely no connection to the scientific proof in hard evidence that's being claimed in some of these other theories. Mm-hmm. They're basking in a false limelight, is my theory. And some of these books that you refer to, I discuss some specific instances of where I think this is so.
Well, what are some of the books? I know there was ones had something, Revolutions and Redheads. What was the title?
Yeah. Okay, there's a series of three books. They're actually collections of short pieces of short fiction pieces and essays on various scientific topics. Plus a mix of any biographical anecdotes and anything else that I felt like throwing in. The first one was called Minds, Machines, and Evolution. And that was produced by Bantam back in the 80s. And people liked it and said they wanted another collection like that. Uh-huh. So the second one was called Rockets, Redheads, and Revolution that you mentioned. And recently, December last year, the third one in a similar pattern was Catastrophes, Chaos, and Convolution.
Have those books generated a lot of discussion with you when people read them?
I was just down in the dealer's room earlier here at the convention, and they tell me they sell very well.
Well, that's good. It's always a good thing. I know that sometimes there's a danger, and sometimes anthologies or collections don't necessarily sell that well.
That's right.
And sometimes that can hurt an author's chances with selling, another novel. But that's good that they are selling well.
I think it's the nonfiction that catches a lot of people's interest in those collections. And then last year we brought out, the hardback came out last year, the paperback has just been released, of a collection, a collection of completely nonfiction essays. That was called Kicking the Sacred Cow.
So what kinds of cows do you kick, or sacred cows do you like to kick?
Well, let's see. We ask questions about the Big Bang, Holt and Arp's observations of high redshift quasars being statistically connected to low redshift but highly energetic galaxies such as Seyferts. Back in the 80s, he started producing tabulations of collections with millions of galaxies out there, obviously there are going to be instances where you get at such alignments, but the methods of analysing statistically how many you ought to get are pretty well known. And ARP demonstrated that it's happening four orders of magnitude more often than it should. Huh. It's happening 10,000 times more often than it should be. And then when a new generation of telescopes went into operation, you know, the Hawaii ones and things like that, the prints now show bridges of matter connecting these objects. The matter radiates in the low-energy X-ray band. So the configuration you typically get is a high-energy disturbed galaxy like a cipher straddled by a pair of quasars. And this configuration appears time and time and time again. And in the more recent pictures, you can see the connection. These bridges of matter lead like rocket trails back to the centers of the galaxies. And the galaxies are disturbed at the cores. This is what makes them high-energy galaxies. And what it points to is that these objects called quasars were actually ejected from the galaxies fairly recently. And you can see the paths that they followed, like rocket trails, as I say. But the objects that were ejected have enormously high redshifts, the highest we measure.
Mm-hmm.
The objects they were ejected from have low redshifts. They're nearby. If Hult and ARP is right, then the distance interpretation of the redshift that has dominated astronomy since the 1920s is wrong.
And what are the implications of that?
Well, the implications is the whole pack of cards comes down and we start rethinking the whole business.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're up against an institution that's you know that prestigious, that amount of funding, that amount of you know, scientific political clout, and all of the weight in terms of its influence on our society, politically, culturally, educationally, mm-hmm. it's not going to give up easily and let go. And the battles that are going on behind the scenes are absolutely ferocious. I mean, Hult and ARP was one of the leading American observational astronomers
mm-hmm.
In the second half of the 20th century. ARP's galaxy of, excuse me, ARP's atlas of peculiar galaxies is a classic in every library. And yet, when he started publishing these anomalous studies, suddenly his funding's cut. He was denied access to the West Coast observatories. The journals that would vie with each other to publish his works won't even read them. He's ridiculed and vilified and personally attacked at conferences. And now he works at the Max Planck Institute in Berlin, which is the only place he can get employment. I mean, this is religious persecution going on, not science.
Uh-huh.
And I've section of Kicking the Sacred Cow is devoted to ARP's work, and sticking on that same example. When I first came across his work back in the late 90s, I was very excited. This is incredible. So the first thing I did was call an astrophysicist I know at NASA
uh-huh.
For a second opinion. Do you know of a fellow called Hult and ARP and his work? Oh, Chip, yeah, we know Chip. Obviously they're old friends. What do you think? And the fellow I spoke to, his voice dropped. You could almost picture him sort of looking over his shoulder to mm-hmm. make sure nobody was in earshot. In a very conspiratorial tone, he said, "We think he's onto something. But," he said, "I wouldn't say so in public, and I wouldn't put my name in writing to a statement to that effect, because my job would be on the line, just like Chip's." And I'm thinking, is this real? Is this America at the end of the 20th century, or are we back in Spain in the 15th? But there we are. That was the reaction I got. So that illustrates the kind of thing I'm discussing in this book. And to go back to your question, what else do we take, a long, hard look at and ask questions like this? And I don't arrive at any particular conclusions myself that I'm trying to ram down anybody's throat.
Uh-huh.
The approach I tried to take in the book was, well, this is how I was raised and what I always believed until I came across this, which made me really sit up and think, my God, this has got me thinking. Here are some of the sources I followed up. This is what they tell me. Here it is, to save you having to collect it all together. Form your own ideas. And we look at Darwinian evolution, Big Bang cosmology. Relativity has got some very interesting cracks in the foundations that are pointed out by distinctly non... It's a risky subject to get involved in because relativity attracts cranks in swarms.
Oh, yeah.
But I decided to risk being branded as one of the swarms and share some of the things I came across.
The way I view science is that things like relativity, evolution, and, you know, Big Bangs, to me, that is the best explanation we have so far. However, there are theories that come along that say, well, this is a better explanation. They, you know, this theory here gives a better explanation of the facts that we observe.
Yeah. And well, take relativity for an example. There was a Czech professor of electrical engineering. He died some years ago, Peter Beckman. He was at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And I knew Peter quite well before he died, but he developed an alternative theory to account for the various phenomena that relativity addresses. Uh-huh. He's not the only one, but it was an example of what are called, rather than observer-based theories, as is relativity, they work on the basis that the velocity of light that matters is the velocity with regard to the dominant energy field in which the observations are being made, or in which the light is through which the light is passing. Without going off into a lot of detail, essentially, Beckman's theory ascribes the peculiarities that occur in high velocities at relativity to changes in the charge distribution of moving charged objects.
Okay.
When objects are moving fast, the charge distribution changes, and therefore the pattern of equipotentials and gradients around the charge change. Space and time remain what they always were and what common sense tells us they were. But the upshot of it all is that in terms of experimental data, the field-referred theories, such as Beckman's, are fully consistent with all the experimental results collected in the last 100 years.
Okay.
They are far simpler conceptually and mathematically. For example, some of the explanations to reconcile the Michelson-Morley experiment with relativity's postulates, we go off into four-dimensional tensor calculus involving Minkowski space and all kinds of stuff that science fiction writers have a lot of fun with. But it leaves people glazed over. Beckman arrives at the same results with about 5 or 6 lines of high school algebra. So we have a theory that is equally compatible with experimental results, simpler mathematically and conceptually, and it's also more powerful predictively.
Okay.
That from first principles, Beckman, he wrote a book called Einstein Plus Two that develops the theory. He explains his theory explains from first principles. He can derive the spacings of the spectrum of the hydrogen atom. He derives the de Broglie wave equation. He derives from first principles and comes very close to deriving the Planck constant, and with a bit of refinement of the theory may succeed in doing so.
Okay.
So here are three fundamental facts of physics that are obtained through observation in the case of hydrogen spacing, a totally different branch of theory, the de Broglie wave equation, and again the Planck constant, which is just a given that falls out of observational physics.
Right.
Relativity has to accept these numbers as given. It has no explanation for them, but the field-inferred theories do. So here we have a theory that is compatible with all the experimental results, simpler conceptually, you know, William of Ockham would be happy,
right,
and more powerful than its predictions. Now, by all the criteria we're told in the textbook, that ought to qualify as the preferred theory. But when it's competing with, you know, a canonized saint, it's not quite that simple. And again, we get all the problems that Halton Arp runs into. In cosmology.
We're almost out of time here.
Okay.
And I want to thank you for allowing me to interview you. This has been a fun interview. Obviously, you know, hopefully with people with different viewpoints. You know, I'm not a scientist myself, but I think it's important that we look at all the ideas, and if there's compelling evidence to, you know, compare and to discern, you know, I'm hoping, you know, of course people are human and they are going to, you know, they're going to accept something as maybe being written in stone, as opposed to, well, this is the best explanation we have. And unfortunately, humans being human, there is going to be resistance to the better theories that come along.
Well, when you think you know and your mind is closed to further input, this is where I think it ceases to be science. And the Greek philosopher Epictetus put it well 2,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. He said, a man cannot begin to learn that which he thinks he already knows. And I think there are areas in science that's falling into this and getting guilty of it. So I try to have a little fun and mix a little humor and share some of these thoughts with readers. And the responses to Kicking the Sacred Cow have been overwhelmingly enthusiastic. I had my body armor and flak jacket on. but the responses have been very supportive, even from scientists in fields, you know, whose subject matter was challenged and questioned.
Mm-hmm.
Would say, you know, you ask some good questions. I don't necessarily agree with all of what you say, but these questions should be asked, shouldn't be hidden, and our young people would be so much the better off if this was openly included in their education.
Mm-hmm.
And they were invited to be aware. I mean, evolution is a good example of this, that there are, we have this false dichotomy in our culture where if you're not a Darwinian, a hardcore Darwinian, you have to be a fundamentalist creationist. And this is not true, but the mm-hmm. media reinforce this perception, and the interesting possibilities are right in the middle there. You know, we're not questioning evolution. We're asking, can natural selection and nothing else explain everything that's going on? I'm not at all sure that it can. And that's where it gets really interesting.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Chris. Are we still on?
Yeah, well, you're welcome.
Okay, Chris. Thanks very much for having me. Yeah.
As you heard, Mr. Hogan is not one to shy away from scientific controversy. With healthy scientific debate, time will tell which views will explain the world around us best. I enjoyed having the opportunity to interview him, and to learn more about him and his writing, you can go to his website, www.jamespphogan.com. It's still a little early to say looking forward to seeing you all at Conestoga 11, so thanks for listening until our next Conestoga podcast. For more information, our web address is www.sftulsa.org. Or send an email to conestoga@sftulsa.org. Questions about our podcast may be sent to podcast@sftulsa.org. Please send us an email or put a comment on the website and let us know what you thought of this podcast.